Henry Ford, the International Jew. Chapter 54, Jew Wires Direct Tamale's Gentile Puppets. I need hardly explain that I do not think Jews ought to insist overmuch on their rights or nationality in a negative sense. They ought to be as much Jews as they can, but ought to be as little as possible of what is merely anti-Christian. For the Jews to try to get a song out of the public schools because it praises Jesus is natural but perhaps hardly wise. I admit that question, however, is an extremely complex and baffling one. Again, the Jews have naturally taken a great interest in this war, but in that case also they ought to choose as far as possible the more tolerant view. Too much hostility to Russia was shown, it seems to me, when some of their spokesmen were fighting over the wording of the Immigration Act. They seemed to be fighting not for a real gain, but simply to rub their political power in America into the Russian mind. Norman Hapgood. The proposal that non-Jews emigrate from New York City, 500,000 in the first exodus, and 500,000 in the second, to hasten the event which is held to be certain of occurrence, namely, that New York shall become an all-Jewish city, may be a joke, but it is no joke that the Jews themselves discuss and have proposed that the city of New York be separated from the state of New York and made both a state and a city in itself. This would entail three governments, state, county and municipal, whose offices the Jews could parcel out as they pleased. Besides, it would rid them of all Albany. It is a most amazing fact that the state capital, as bad as it is, has always been able to defeat the New York Jew in his more ardently pursued quests, as notably, his insistent appeal to abrogate the Sunday law. Of course, if the non-Jews emigrated from New York, the Jews would soon follow. They are not self-sufficient. If New York could be isolated, Jewish initiative would not suffice to provide enough potatoes for the inhabitants. It is too trite to say that New York is already in the hands of the Jews. But it would be most startling to give a schedule illustrating how completely this is so. The New Yorker himself can scarcely comprehend the extent of his vassalage to the Jew. The average intelligent New Yorker does not know what Bakihila is, nor yet how it works. Like a child born within the sound of Niagara Falls, the New Yorker takes Jewish supremacy as a matter of course, as the way things should be, and as the way they probably are elsewhere. The New Yorker is thus like a native of the Balkans. The Hyland administration, ostensibly non-Jewish, is really Jewish, as any New York administration must necessarily be, except there should arise a man whose ambition would be to prove that New York could be better governed if the Jews should be excluded from the government. Well-informed New Yorkers say that the power of Hyland is Sheffield. This is a rather peculiar situation to those who do not understand how the Jewish leaders work. Directly you say the Hyland administration is Jewish, it is objected, but it is the arch-Jewish Inquisitor Untermeyer, who is trying to break down the Hyland administration, exactly. That is the game. It's inside and outside that does it. There is power gained in making them and there is power gained in breaking them, and often it is profitable to try both ways with the same man. That is the way Russia went. There were Jews plentifully sprinkled throughout the government of Russia, in spite of the persecution, and there were Jews outside. Between the two they got Russia. It is the same in a Texas city today. Four non-Jewish candidates for postmaster were made the center of a political deadlock. Up through the deadlock pops a Jew as a compromise candidate for all sections. A sufficient number of Jews were available in that city to keep all non-Jewish candidates in a deadlock until their own man was trotted out. The Gentile mind, of course, does not easily realize these turnings and twistings of group conspiracy. And that is why the Jews feel safe, as a rule. They rely on what they call Gentile stupidity. The Gentile says, incredible, and the traditional Jewish game is incredible. Until by mountainous proofs and centuries of illustration the actuality of it is forced home to the mind. But to return to the New York City government, The police department has its Jewish streak in the higher offices, a Jewish police commissioner who has fortunately escaped thus far the full story of his career. The Department of Health, where it actually touches the people, is Jewish, although occasionally a distinguished non-Jewish name meets the eye in the roster of the higher officials. The public health is becoming more and more a Jewish monopoly in our cities. The Department of Accounts, the Board of Child Welfare, the Board of Inebriety, the Municipal Service Commission, the Board of Taxes and Assessments, are all under the leadership and domination of Jews. The judiciary becomes increasingly Jewish, litigation is almost overwhelmingly Jewish, and the consequences to the reputation of the courts of justice and the profession of the law are well understood. Real estate exploitation and speculation is strictly Jewish, the profiteers treating even their own co-nationalists with the utmost cruelty. In short, New York's most influential press, within New York, is the Yiddish press, New York's real government is the Yiddish Kehilla, New York's real administration of the law is the Yiddish administration, New York's real politics is Jewish. A little more, and New York's official language would be the Yiddish dialect. In all this, Tammany Hall is little more than a name. It is one of the rallying centers which the Jews have left the non-Jew who still interests himself in New York politics. There must be rallying places for the non-Jews, and one ought to do not hurt. The Jew has the double advantage in such a matter, for while he claims equality with all, he denies equality with any. That is, any Jew proclaims his right to join any fraternity, or any club, or any society, or any party whose members are chiefly non-Jewish, but where is the Jewish fraternity, or club, or society that admits non-Jewish members? The newspapers carried the report, after a certain occurrence, that hundreds of Jews had offered to join the Knights of Columbus. It is very typical of Jewish character. But let any non-Jew attempt to join Bnei Brit or the Hebrew Young Men's Association or the Menorah Society, or any of the others, he will see how far the principle of equality operates. We want to be part of yours, but we want our own for ourselves, is the Jewish attitude. So, politically, the New York Jew has the advantage. He belongs together with the non-Jew, to organizations like Tammany or the Republican Club, but the non-Jew cannot with him belong to the Kehilla. It is also very familiar, the Jew insists on double everywhere. In the Balkans he insists on double citizenship. He insists on a double protection. He insists on a double standard of education. He insists on all his own religious rights as strenuously as he insists that all Christian majority rights shall be stamped out in this country. He insists that he shall have his Sabbath and that you shall not have yours. He wants his own social rights and yours too, but he wants you to have only your own and not his with it. It casts serious doubts on Jewish intelligence that this course should be so seriously pursued, as if on the one hand the humor of the nerve, and on the other hand the disgusting impudence of it, had never appeared to his consciousness. In New York, therefore, the Jew politically belongs twice, while all non-Jews belong but once, and it can easily be perceived that this is an advantage. In the previous article it was rehearsed how Tammany besmirched its name by association with Jews who used the organization as a protection for their traffic in vice. This was in 1894. The revelations were so terrible that in any other community they would have led to a complete abolition of any possible chance of recovery, but as it was never made plain to the people that the traffic in vice was not a sudden appearance of rottenness among Americans, but was the normal activity of an alien racial strain, the moral power of exposure was dissipated. The people were left staggered by what they were allowed to believe about the origin of the horror. People said it was Tammany because the press said it was Tammany, and yet people could not understand how it could be Tammany, and so in the midst of hesitancy the fire of reform burned out. It was exactly like these days when we are told that American businessmen abroad are doing terrible things, yet even while the press declares them to be American we cannot understand how Americans could do such things, and we never get the key to the matter, nor see the solution. until we stumble on the fact that these so-called Americans are not Americans at all, but alien Jews. Over in Canada, the name American is becoming a stigma because it is borne by men who are not Americans. What Canadians point out in the United States as definitely American is mostly Jewish, but how are the Canadians to know? The national name suffers. The whole cause of evil is camouflaged and a nation pays the price of a racial group's misdeeds. There should be some method of protecting this forging of national names. Thus Tammany became a synonym for what was not characteristically Tammany at all, but what was characteristically Jewish. The exposure of 1894 disclosed that vice was really a thing of cold blood. Evil that springs from passion and impulse really amounts to far less than is commonly supposed. It is when passion is deliberately cultivated and impulse stimulated that the great bulk of the world's social evil occurs. And this stimulation is undertaken in cold blood by those who make profit out of providing the means of gratification, like the old-fashioned barkeepers who served very salty free lunches to stimulate the sale of beer. This kind of vice is not a thing to be shamed by exposure, as can be done with involuntary vice, as it might be called. This cold-blooded merchandising of human weakness was merely a matter of profits, and if business had been interfered with by a XO committee, it was rather unfortunate, but good business required that operations be resumed at the earliest possible moment. And so, though the investigations of 1894 were successful and the exposure duly made, it was not to be expected that mere oratory and printer's ink would suffice to keep the serpent down. It was only 7 years before scandal flamed again throughout the length and breadth of New York, and strange enough in all conscience for Gentile fronts of this day and generation to heed. It was found again that the traffic in evil and its ramifications all over the land, and even to foreign countries, was in the hands of Jews. There was no doubt about it. There was even no accident about it. The fact was as continuous as it was colossal. William Travers Jerome, then Justice of the Court of Special Sessions, made in 1901 a ringing indictment of conditions in the city and used the full power of his court to punish wrongdoers. He even went so far as to specify individuals and political connections, but he did not mention the key word of it all, which was Jew. It was doubtless wise for him that he did not, else he could not have enjoyed the subsequent political career which came to him. Tammany was defeated in the election of 1901. The defeat was due to the same cause, the stigma of Jew-controlled vice traffic under political protection. It was at this time that Richard Croker abdicated. He was a rich man. He sailed for Ireland. Here he became a country squire on his wantage estate. Public curiosity was fed the statement that Croker had selected Lewis Nixon to be his successor, but this turn in Tammany's career is too important to be thus misstated. The truth is that when Croker left, he surrendered Tammany to the Jews. Croker could confirm this if he would talk, if he should be permitted to talk. It is, however, not well to have garrulous old men spilling secrets of other days. Croker in his age took a bride who is said to be of Indian descent, and he has not been much in touch with his family nor the public since. Lewis Nixon was the convenient and perhaps unconscious Gentile front. The real ruler of Tammany in Croker's stead was Andrew Friedman, mentioned in the former article as Croker's friend and housemate. Judging from the habit of individual Jews to room with baseball players before the baseball scandal, and the result of another Jew's living with Croker, it might be just as well to keep an eye on those other men who are in positions to do favors or influence legislation, whose close cronies happen to be Jews. Some of these friendships may indeed be perfectly conceived, but there are numerous instances where the plans of the Jewish friend are very completely matured through the agency of the Gentile chum. So, upon departure of Croker from these shores, we find Tammany under the dictatorship of a Jew who was Croker's chief influence, if not his absolute master. But by the time this occurred, It was useless for Tammany to rebel. Tammany men who had noticed the infiltration of Jews and were alarmed by it had consoled themselves with the thought that, at least, the higher offices were immune from Jewish occupation. This consolation served only to permit the filling of the lower offices by Jews, with less protest from the membership. By the time the Jews were ready to permit Cricker to abdicate, they had permeated every part of the wigwam and the assumption of supreme control was thus made a simple matter. Cricker stepped aside, instantly into his place stepped the Jew, Friedman, operating through Nixon. It was too late for Tammany to remonstrate. Tammany could not protest against the wigwam becoming Jewish, because the wigwam already was Jewish. To remonstrate then was to ruin Tammany. Becoming reconciled to what seemed to be inevitable, Tammany leaders saw that their only hope of survival came through preserving Jewish support. Presently, even Nixon was relegated to the background and Friedman issued his orders directly. The Jews, however, with great astuteness continued to make much of Nixon, because he was the last thin veil which concealed the change which had come over Tammany, and he was valuable to that extent. He was unwillingly, perhaps, their puppet, but even puppets must be accorded their proper dignity. Nixon was tendered a great reception in 1902, but the influential men on the reception committee were mostly Jews. Andrew Friedman was chairman, then followed the names of Oliver H. P. Belmont, Max F. Ehmson, Samuel Untermeyer, Nathan Strauss, Randolph Guggenheimer, Henry M. Goldfogel, Herman Joseph, and others. On the executive committee of Tammany Hall at this time were Randolph Guggenheimer, Isaac Fromm, Nathan Strauss, Henry M. Goldfogel, O. H. P. Belmont, and other Jews. On the committee on law were Samuel Untermeyer, M. Wallet Platsek, Abraham Levy, Henry W. Undia, Morris Kuker and Fred B. House. Andrew Friedman had complete control of the Committee on Finance that was nominally headed by Lewis Nixon. Randolph Guggenheimer was president of the Municipal Council. Ferdinand Levy was on the Committee on Resolutions and Correspondence. Jews had so spread themselves as to constitute a controlling group in all the assembly districts that were under tribute to Tammany. In the Fighting 8th District, Martin Engel was leader. His chief aide was Manny Eichner, chairman of the Zidicone Association and of the Young Men's Democratic Association. His other assistants, Max J. Podges, Max Levin, and Moe Levy were floor managers of the dances and balls of the Florence Sullivan Association. In the 10th District, Simon Stangut, Mayor of 2nd Avenue, was one of the hardest workers in Tammany affairs. Edward Mandel was the active Jewish Tammany man in the 12th District. In the 18th District, Morris Blumenthal was one of the principal workers. He devoted his career chiefly to the training of Jewish speakers for the wigwam. The 18th District was known as the Gashouse District, notorious for the Gashouse scandals over padded payrolls, and here Charlie Murphy ruled, his aides being Julius Simon, Edward E. Slumarski, Joseph Schlesinger, Leopold Worms, Hugo Siegel, Alfred B. Marx, Nathan Fernbaker, and other Jews. And so on through the list. Among the sachems of the Tammany Society there were to be found the wealthier and more socially exalted Jews. However, the Jews made their cyclically recurrent mistakes, they carried things with too high a hand, and rebellion broke out. It is this Jewish tendency to boast and overdo that has always given the game away. Superficial observers and writers like John Spago and Norman Hapgood have observed the recurrent periods of protest against Jewish presumption and bumptiousness and have explained them as being recurrent spasms of a vile poison which is supposed to reside in the blood of the Gentiles, the vile poison of anti-Semitism. That, of course, is the conventional Jewish propagandist explanation, and Spago and Hapgood are merely retailing it. They say it always breaks out after wars. Why after wars? Because in wars the world sees more clearly than at other times the real purpose and personality of the Jew. Thus, it is not anti-Semitism that breaks out, it is Semitism, gross and exaggerated Semitism, and the serum that forms in the social body to insist and control the germ of Semitism comes in the form of public exposure and protest. That serum is working now, the serum of publicity, and the Jewish program cannot endure it. Study the history of all things whatsoever into which Jews inject themselves, from summer resorts to empires, and you see the same cycle appearing. Thus it happened in Tammany Hall, too much Jew, engendered revolt. Lewis Nixon became aware of his position. As a gentleman of standing and responsibility, he could not continue in a position whose falsity had become clear to him. When he accepted the leadership of Tammany Hall, it was not with a purpose to continue the old order. His understanding was that he was to be left free to restore Tammany to the plane of its former serious purpose and respectable character. He discovered he was being used as the respectable Gentile front, behind whose name the Jews expected to carry on the old game. Therefore, in May, 1902, 3 months after the great reception above mentioned, Nixon resigned as leader of Tammany Hall. Doubtless the reception that was tendered him was for the purpose of inducing him to love the exaltation of his position so much that he would sacrifice its moral obligations. Nixon accompanied his resignation with a speech in which he protested that ever since he had accepted the leadership of Tammany he had been hampered in his every action by a group headed by Andrew Friedman. They dictated the names that were to be placed on the list of sachems. When I rebelled, I found that at every turn I would be opposed by this coterie of interferers. I found that all my important acts had to be vised before they could become effective. He said he could no longer retain his position and his self-respect, he had to give up one or the other. With this, Mr. Nixon vanished from the scene of Tammany politics. The resignation of Mr. Nixon had a bad effect on the reputation of Tammany with the public. The plan had been to allow him to serve as long as ordinarily and then replace him with a Jew by means of the usual process of selection. But the resignation and the explanation that accompanied it, showing as it did the Jewish influence in Tammany, made it seem inadvisable to follow with a Jewish leader. So the district leaders were obliged to find another Gentile front, only this time one who would prove sufficiently docile. There was enough rankling disfavor against the Jews in the old organization to warrant this observance of appearances, at least. The dictatorship of Friedman was seen to be a failure, much as the dictatorship of Trotsky is seen to be a failure. A rearrangement of committees automatically eliminated him from control, at the same time the name of Kruker was dropped. A triumvirate of leaders was chosen, of whom Charles F. Murphy became and remains the chief, Boss Murphy, he is called. Mr. Murphy has been an ideal front, not attempting to do anything, not attempting to interfere with the Jews doing anything, keeping wisely silent and thereby gaining a reputation of silent wisdom. Mr. Murphy is a millionaire. Those who do the higher Jewish leaders' bidding get their reward that way. There is no other reward they can hope for, certainly they never have a reward of public confidence and the people's gratitude. That is the status of Tammany Hall at the present time. A few of the old guard are left at their posts, but they are officers in name only. Tammany is no longer denounced by the public press, but the Jewish leaders of Tammany live daily to a chorus of praise in the Jewish-controlled newspapers of New York. Samuel Untermeyer, for example, receives more publicity in New York than does the President of the United States, but it is not discriminating publicity, it does not penetrate to the inner purposes and consequences of his actions. Those who were the lesser Jewish lieutenants of Tammany a few years ago have now arrived at posts of influence and affluence. Morris Kuker was made President of the Municipal Service Commission, to be succeeded by former State Senator Abraham Kaplan. Fred B. House rose to be a city magistrate. The city marshals are mostly Jewish. Jews predominate in the College of the City of New York. Jews control the municipal courts, the city magistrates' courts, the city court, the New York State Court of Appeals, the New York State Supreme Court. They rule in the departments enumerated in the forepart of this article. The New York judiciary has a distinctly Semitic complexion. The leadership of the Tammany-controlled districts tells the same story. In the second, the leader is M.S. Levine, in the sixth, David Lazarus, in the eighth, S. Goldenkrantz, F. Bauman and S. Salinger, in the ninth, Mrs. P. Lau, in the 17th, Nathan Burkne, and so on. The Jewish conquest of Tammany, however, is only one phase of the conquest of New York. The Jewish objective is more than political. Merely to strive that the lucrative and powerful offices of the city shall fall to their people, is not the end in view. New York has been turned into the red center of America. There most of the alien treason carried on against the government of the United States has its source. The United States government has been compelled at times to regard New York as almost alien soil, but even that watchfulness on the part of the national government is relaxed as Jewish influence becomes more potent at Washington. Tammany is a convenient cover for ostensible political activity as the Kehilla is for the more radical and anti-American racial activity. The United States government could not do better than to investigate, through a committee of invulnerable Americans, the Jewish activities of that center. And that there is much to investigate is indicated by the rush of Jews to Washington when it was recently proposed in the United States Senate that such a thing be done. The Dearborn Independent, issue of 1 October 1921.